Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Proof. Everyone's hair is unique. Find your best hair at livingproof.com by taking a quiz to get your perfect mix of product. Use the code NOFRIZZ at livingproof.com for a free travel-size humidity shield with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Squarespace. Whether for business or just for the fun of it, Squarespace offers easy-to-create websites with award-winning templates and 24/7 support. Start a free trial today. Go to squarespace.com and remember to enter offer code MODERNLOVE to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, set your website apart.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Nothing teaches a person more about what's important and who's important than a near-death experience. But it can also leave us wondering how important we are, as it did for Catherine Friedman Holland. Catherine Keener reads her story. She's known for her Oscar-nominated performances in the films Being John Malkovich and Capote. Here she is with Catherine Friedman Holland's essay, Live Without Me, I'll Understand.
We are flying to a resort south of Cancun for the wedding of my husband's cousin. As we rise into the cloudless Los Angeles sky, I try, as always, to suppress my unease. I have always been afraid of flying, but today I am tired enough to doze off as we make our way south. Just over an hour into the flight, there is a slight bump, followed by a distinct click as overhead panels fall open and the oxygen masks unfurl. Then the plane begins to plunge.
This is an emergency. Please put on your oxygen mask and fasten seatbelt. This is an emergency.
I look pleadingly at my husband of 6 months. It's okay, he says, just as he has on so many other flights when I panicked at an unfamiliar noise or dip. We are going to be okay. This time is different. The plane is racing downward, my seatbelt pulling taut against my lap. My mind fumbles to assemble a picture of what is happening, but each piece of information seems disconnected, absurd. The cabin is eerily quiet. Shouldn't someone be screaming? I think I hear a muffled sob, but I cannot look at the other passengers. The flight attendants, doubled against gravity, pull themselves up the aisles by the armrests, bent over like mountain climbers, one holding an oxygen mask to her face, the man behind her cradling the portable tank in his arm. No one speaks. There is the smell of something smoldering. A fire? Engine failure? I look into my husband's eyes, begging for reassurance or an explanation. Again, he says, we're okay. The smoldering smell is strong now. And so we say what people say when they think it is the last thing the other will ever hear. I love you. I love you too. So this is it. The scene in the diving plane seems choreographed, rehearsed, as if I have been waiting for it to happen my entire life. Yet my reactions are alien. Yes, my heart is pounding through my fingers and my pupils feel as if they are about to burst. But the sense of panic, the urge to scream or cry, is absent. There is no instant replay of my life. No existential secrets are revealed to me. Could the moments before death really be this banal? I feel a deep and penetrating sadness for our parents and my sister. A wave of empathy for our friends when they hear the news. But I know life will go on for them. They have no choice. And so, in a falling plane over the sand-coated Mexican canyons, I look out the window into the endless orange afternoon. And I wait. And then the plane stops falling. It levels, dips, levels again. Our seatbelts slacken. The captain's shaky voice informs us that we will be making an emergency landing. We can remove our masks. There is no need to assume crash position. It will be a normal landing. Sometime later, we touch down at a small domestic airport 3 hours south of the American border. As the plane taxis, the cabin is silent. A flight attendant wipes away tears. The pilot stands ashen-faced in the cockpit, nodding as we file past. But no one speaks to him, and he offers no words of explanation. In the tiny airport lounge, we scatter into clusters, not making eye contact, seemingly embarrassed to have shared this near tragedy. I try to reach out to a young girl who is traveling alone to meet friends for spring break. I can tell she's been crying. "That was my worst nightmare," she says. "Mine too," I reply. I don't cry until I hear my father's voice on the payphone. And then I am afraid I won't stop. So I hand the phone to my husband, but not before saying to my father, "I can't get back on a plane." "Yes," he says, "you can." So we wait for word. An airline official appears and says perhaps they will try to fix the plane and fly us out later in the evening. But the passengers rumble collectively in protest. No one wants to board that plane again. Instead, the airline detours the flight, half full of mildly surprised passengers, to pick us up and take us to Mexico City. From there, they put us on another plane to Cancun. The hotel is colonial and enormous. We are tagged with white plastic wristbands for the all-you-can-eat-and-drink buffets, and then we head to our rooms to sleep. The next morning, predictably, is washed in sunshine. At the beach, children shriek and tumble in the gentle surf. Their hair braided tightly into cornrows affixed with plastic beads. Everyone rejoices in the delights of this paradise. I stand and watch, transfixed. My husband and I have barely spoken since the events of the day before. And when we do, it is in low tones, as if we are watching a performance we don't want to disturb. We try to talk about what happened on the plane, try to reconstruct it, and then we stop. He wants to move past it, I can tell. "We're lucky," he repeats. I nod, but the truth is, I don't feel lucky, or even alive. I feel indifferent. All I can do is watch everyone around me experience what I should be feeling. No, it's worse. I watch them and condemn them for the utter uselessness of their joy. When it is time to go, we take the shuttle to the airport. I wait for the familiar tingle of anticipation about returning home and the surge of anxiety upon boarding the airplane. But I feel neither. For the first time in my life, I am not afraid to fly. In fact, I am not afraid of anything. But the feeling is not one of liberation. I am still searching for something, even my old fear, to tether me to my previous life. But there is only this feeling of utter remove. And suddenly, as our plane pushes skyward, its engines roaring, I am taken back to that moment when the universe tightened its grip, threatening to peel me from my family, my friends, my memories, a future I would never know. For a second I resisted. I asked, how can my loved ones and I exist apart? How can I be lost to the world? We spend our lives binding ourselves to one another, attaching ourselves to this life like mollusks clinging to the reef. But as that plane dropped from the sky, I knew that the world would go on without me. My friends would grieve and move on. My loved ones would endure. All I had to do was accept this and let go. So I did. But we didn't crash. Here I remain, among friends and loved ones, at the beginning of my marriage and all the fierce entanglements of my life. Yet, in letting go, it seems I created a break between my former and current selves that isn't so easily bridged. At home, I go to the grocery store, rub the dog's belly, fold the laundry, all the routines and rituals that are supposed to give life structure and meaning. But week after week, I am still in that other place, a half step removed, wondering when and how I am ever going to come back from this. A month after my return, the answer comes in the form of a phone call, summoning me to the emergency room. My father has had a heart attack. It is not until I am beside him in the intensive care unit, gripping his hand as he battles his weakened heart for each breath, that I feel my own heart pounding again for the first time since that day. It's all so familiar, the panic, the terror, the threat of imminent loss. But this time, I don't let go. My father, laced with wires and unconscious, is pulling me back.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Catherine Keener, reading Catherine Friedman Holland's essay, Live Without Me, I'll Understand. It's been almost 10 years since the incident on the plane. We'll hear what's happened since, after the break.
Support for Modern Love, the podcast, comes from Living Proof, the science behind healthy hair.
I'm Katie from Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. Dear Living Proof, I thought I was going to have to cut off all of my hair. So dry and frizzy. My new hairdresser gave me no-frizz shampoo and the leave-in conditioner, and now I have a full head of bouncy, shiny hair. Awesome stuff. Love, Donna. Use the code NOFRIZZ for a free travel-size humidity shield with your $20 order. Livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and now a postscript from the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, Daniel Jones, and the author of this week's essay, Kathryn Friedman Holland.
When we got back, I really wanted answers. I wanted to understand what had happened, why it had happened. And I wrote to the airline, and the bottom line is there are valves in the plane that keep it pressurized. And there was a malfunction with one of these valves that caused the cabin to become depressurized. And when that happens, the protocol is that the pilot has to get down to an altitude where you can breathe without the oxygen masks as quickly as possible. So the dive that we experienced was actually a controlled dive that the pilot was making intentionally, but he just didn't have time to explain that. And so in the moment, when you don't know what's going on, it's pretty terrifying. In the immediate aftermath of that experience, my fear of flying disappeared, but it disappeared along with a lot of other things and emotions and anxieties, because I don't know if you'd describe it as sort of a post-traumatic stress reaction or mild depression or something, but it was part of that flat affect that I was feeling afterwards, where I just, you know, the fears were gone, but so were so many other emotions that engaged me in life and in the world. And then, you know, after my dad had his heart attack and I felt kind of pulled back into the business of life and all the complicated, you know, emotions and entanglements and everything, the fear started to return to the point that I even went and took a fear of flying course in Northern California, and it was helpful in many ways. I would say I'm back to being an uneasy flyer, but I refuse to let it prevent me from experiencing my life.
Kathryn's essay is the kind of essay that we run in Modern Love occasionally that really stretches the definition of what modern love can be. You know, people might wonder, how is that about love? But at the deepest level, what this experience does to her, it makes her question, what did that love amount to at the end, and what did those bonds amount to at the end? You know, what's so refreshing and interesting to me about Kathryn's essay is how it turns the cliche of the near-death experience on its head. When you're in a car accident, or you survive cancer treatment, or in her case, you're on a plane that you think is going down, you think, okay, well, once you get through that, you're so more appreciative of life and so much more appreciative of love. And hers is the opposite experience, but in understandable ways. It's a realization for her that is so sort of stark and disappointing that she doesn't know how to sort of accommodate that into her life when her life keeps continuing.
My husband, you know, we just have different attitudes, I think, about life. And, you know, later when we talked about it, and I sort of said, what were you thinking? Like, what did you really believe this was it? And he said, no, I thought the plane would crash land somewhere, and I was looking out the window and just figuring out our escape plan, like how we would get out. Whereas I just went to the place of it's over, you know, like we're done. And I could say that's become sort of a metaphor for our marriage, where I'm ready to just give up and he's always, you know, has a plan and a way that we're going to get through things.
Catherine and her husband live in Los Angeles with their two sons, who are 7 and 9 years old. And there's someone else in Catherine's life who's helped her through the experience.
So I'm happy to say my dad turned 91 in December. He still puts on his three-piece suit every single day and goes into his law firm. He's no longer technically practicing law, but he's just someone who doesn't waste a day. My dad always said it's better to be lucky than smart. And I do in so many ways feel like I've been so lucky, and I'm grateful for that.
Catherine Friedman Holland, author of Live Without Me, I'll Understand. We also heard from Modern Love editor Dan Jones. And now we want to hear from you on this. Have you had a near-death experience? What did it teach you about love? Did it cause you to make any big decisions in your relationship? Or did it reveal any regrets you have in your love life? Record a voice memo, keep it to 60 seconds or less, please, and email it to modernlove@wbur.org. Special thanks to Catherine Keener for reading this week's essay. You can see her later this year in the films Unless and We Don't Belong Here. Next week on Modern Love, you might know him as Gary Walsh on Veep, or maybe as Buster Bluth in Arrested Development. Tony Hale reads a story about getting dumped and falling hard.
Did she have her reasons? Could I have been a better boyfriend? Is it telling that I was 48 when we met and never married? And that I had recently looked in the mirror and seen staring back male pattern baldness and the egregious folly of my broken field running brand of romance. Ha! No good can come from dwelling on such questions.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippins. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week. If you love Modern Love, check out WBUR's advice podcast, Dear Sugar, where hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond answer all your questions, no matter how deep or dark. Subscribe to Dear Sugar on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Squarespace is proud to help make Modern Love possible. Please visit squarespace.com and build your own website. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all available and easy to build. Start your free trial today. And remember to use the code MODERNLOVE for 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Set your website apart.